Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook. I'm your host, Robin Hunneke, here today with Asif Anayal, the brothers behind Peanut Button, studio that created The Secret of Retropolis, a really successful VR title that recently debuted at Cannes Film Festival. And we're going to talk today about virtual reality development and specifically thinking about building prototypes, how to get stories working in this exciting new medium, and the ways specifically that character and narrative interact with virtual reality spaces to create something better than we can experience in other locations. And so I'm really excited to have you all listen to this episode and share the brothers with you. Here they are.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Today with Saf and Ayel Geva, who are visiting us through the internet from Tel Aviv. They are the co-founders of the studio Peanut Button and also brothers. Welcome to the show.
Hey, hi, thanks for having us. We're thrilled to be here.
I think, first of all, we always begin by saying that we appreciate you taking the time to be on the show, especially in these times when we need to connect with one another more closely. It's great to be able to interview people from all over the world and talk about video games, and specifically to talk about fresh, new, innovative work, which you are doing. When we get started here, the first thing that we typically do is just ask you to tell us a little bit about how you got into video games in the first place. And as brothers, you probably have an origin story that's interesting. So I'd love to hear what got you started down the path that you're on right now. How did you become two brothers making a video game together?
I guess it ties up with stuff we did when we were kids already. We liked playing video games as kids and also creating all sorts of short stories, short animations, short projects, just, you know, creating a bunch of stuff together. That was always fun. And then after finishing high school and you know, starting off a career, I took a path of computer science and animation studies, and Eyal went to study cinema, or what was it called? Film?
Film studies and film. Screenwriting.
Yeah, so film and screenwriting. And it was really natural for us to kind of keep working together on projects on the side together. So one thing we did, I think it was 2014, is we did like a type of a chat roulette website that was dedicated to the Gaza operation that was going on then.
And there. The political the polarization.
Wow.
Yeah. So basically, it was a really simple chat. A UI came up and asked you if you're a leftist or a right or right wing person. And then it randomly put you in a fight or in a chat with someone from the other side.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah, it was a time in 2014 that we were naive, and somehow suddenly the internet exploded with violence from political reasons and fake accounts and fake news. We didn't call it fake news at the time. So this is was our way to make something that it's not really a game, but it is a gamified experience of talking to someone with different views, and it got some really big attention, and it was mentioned in mainstream media and the news, and we were doing interviews, and it was the first thing we did that wow, really took off, and it was frightening, actually, because it was a kind of a joke.
It was like releasing a demon. For us, it was like our take on, you know, how the same debate on social media repeats itself over and over and over. So we just created a machine where you can just repeat
Yeah.
The debate you're
and also
with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people, and there's no nickname. So the nickname is leftist or rightist.
Okay.
And I'm most proud in the button that let you switch sides.
Yeah. So once you decide you want to end the chat, you can go on to the next chat, or next to it there was a button switch sides, which made it more like a role play type of experience for us.
And I imagine there must have been all kinds of reactions to it and people having all sorts of thoughts about who you were and what it meant about you, as to people just building something interesting or as a joke or kind of the, like you said, way to maybe release a demon in some ways. What did you learn from the experience? What was something that you know now about yourselves or your creative process that you wouldn't know if you hadn't sort of taken this random leap into the space?
So I think this is the first time we created something interactive together. Correct me if I'm wrong.
As kids, we made some PowerPoint
slideshows. Yeah. So like interactive stories in PowerPoint and stuff like that. But it's the first time we actually created something interactive and put it out there. Beforehand, we did some YouTube videos, I guess, and stuff like that.
Movies before they were like homemade movies before YouTube.
Yeah.
This is what we did.
Yeah.
Basically that was something we did a lot. And I'm trying to think, that's kind of a detour from the main origin story, but
no, it's great.
I think that we learned how we work together well.
Yeah.
Like what each one of us is more doing. Like I took more the copywriting side and the PR side, like booking interviews and we did it. It wasn't a startup. It didn't have any business model. It just took off. And we knew it's a joke that would hold up for a month, at least.
Yeah.
So, we did it. So I booked up interviews, and Asaf did his magic with the server that I have no idea how, till this day, I don't know how a server for chat is working.
Me neither, by the way.
Yeah.
But you did it.
Yeah, no, but I quickly forgot about all the multiplayer, but...
the network.
Now
stuff,
we're...
Yeah,
now it's all single player.
Yeah.
For us.
No, and also now we make games. It wasn't a game.
Yeah.
And we wanted to make something that is more narrative and not just a joke for a month, but something that people can... have meaningful experience with, and it's not just a joke.
Yeah, so from there on, we were still both students at the time, but during the time we were studying, I came across a VR developer kit in my university, and it blew me away. Like, I'm sure a lot of people in VR told you about the moment they first experienced VR, or you yourself have this kind of memory of the first time you put a VR goggle on.
Yeah.
And so I just had to order one developer kit home. And it was, you know, I brought it to Eyal. He also had this kind of epiphany moment of, aha, there's so much potential here. So basically, when I got it, I had in the back of my head the idea that we can create stuff together with it. But the first thing I had on my mind at the time was making a proposal to my girlfriend at the time to marry. And it was really basic then. There was no touch controllers or tracked hand controllers. It was just, you know, you viewing around. So what I did was a series of miniatures that each one was a different memory we had during a relationship. And the last memory, there was this interface where you could go back and forward with your gaze. So the last memory was of me proposing to her and her having the VR headset on her. And so she saw it in VR and thought, okay, this is a memory that's happening right now. She took off the headset and saw me proposing.
That's really fantastic.
So that's some, I don't know, that basically taught me the power of this medium, I guess, because otherwise I wouldn't stand a chance. and from there on, it was okay. What else can we make with it that it's not, you know, a tool for for, you know, us doing something personal in our lives, but like how we can bring out something artistic. And I think here the go-to for me was to come up with it to Eyal, who is the idea guy, and ask him, what can we make with it, you think?
So I was fresh out of film school. I wrote a script for feature film because I really love movies. I like old movies and new movies. I really wanted to make them. But if you don't live in LA, if you do live in LA, you have like 1% to make your dream script come alive. If you don't live there, the odds are really low. So I was figuring out how the hell do you make a feature film happen just because you think it's a good script. And I kind of found out it's really hard. And also I learned a lot. I worked in TV and radio and film, and I saw this industry is not exactly welcoming new talent if it's from the behind the scenes, because they know how to make their own stuff. They don't really look for something new unless it's a knockoff of something that is already successful. And I saw all the indie filmmakers, friends, trying to really do something that is very inspirational, but rarely get to the finish line of making your own indie feature film. And then Asaf brings the idea of doing VR together. And when he brings me the headset, the first thing I see is not the the showcase or some demo of what VR can do. He made a simple scene of one character, and he asked, okay, what can we do? And I used my unemployed screenwriter mind to try to come up with a story. And we made a few prototypes, and they were not good. They were really, really bad because we didn't had any idea what we're doing. But yeah. It was very fast to understand. Using VR, using this technology, gives you so much power as a creator. Like if you wanted to make an impactful story in a feature film, you need a crew, you need to shoot actors, you need to do so much, and then to do the marketing and the distribution, it's really, really hard. But in VR, our small prototypes with everything not good in them, the story is not good, the interaction were bad, the puzzles, people at first didn't understand we were making puzzles. They just didn't know what it is because we tried something new, but we saw how captivating it is for people. Much more than watching someone's dream feature film and scrolling their phone. In VR, you can't scroll your phone.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the big thing.
It's one of the last places where people have to really pay attention. And so you have all this freedom with their attention that it's actually, I feel like a lot of people that haven't developed for VR don't understand how empowering it is and also how intimidating it is to have all that attention back, because we're sort of used to living in a world where people spend 30 to 40% of their time when they're engaging with most things staring at their phone on the side. You know, it's a novel experience these days.
Yeah. And I think it's a short time frame where you don't have the distractions built in, you know, baked into the VR itself, but we're enjoying it as it is now. So
yeah, let's take
we don't want it to go anywhere. We like it as it is now. We're not looking for the metaverse. We're trying to make good things with what there is now. Yeah, exactly.
It is inevitable. So okay, so you have this new technology in your hands, and you're seeing all the capacity that it has and that you can get into development pretty quickly. There are some choices that you have to make. Did you decide that it would just be the two of you? Did you decide you would start a company? Like, were you just like, we're going to just make something together? Or did you like, yeah, what was that part like, VR game? Like, I know it doesn't seem like a big leap to you, but it is.
No, it is. And it took time for us to come to the realization that it's a company, that it's not just the both of us. And we'll talk later about Daniel, who did all the art for the game and how extending the team basically made it possible to make something that can, you know, be representable in the world. I think the first thing we did is like do after hours projects together. So we after college, we both had day jobs, and but we looked for competitions in VR, and we made prototypes and game jams and stuff like that.
Competitions meaning not esport competitions, like, yeah, festivals, film festivals where,
yeah,
you can show
like
your
that, exhibitions. This was where we worked and did our personal stuff in VR. We're talking about 2017, I think, around that time. And at some point we said, okay, this is something. Like, we didn't define it as gaming per se. It was more like interactive storytelling and all sorts of experiments in how you can interact with virtual characters to convey story and world. And at some point we said, okay, let's quit our day jobs. And what we did is basically doubled down on the amount of prototypes we made. And so our learning curve was much faster. And I think the next step was the first commercial project we did was,
but maybe, yeah, it's interesting to talk about the prototypes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe say a few words about this.
Yeah, of course. So let's see. What prototype do you think is most representable to talk
None
about?
None of them.
None of them.
This is the interesting thing.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, I mean, there were a lot of fun. We did all the voices, so as you can tell.
Yeah, it's fun to dork around in VR in general. It's just fun.
Exactly. It was us dorking around. There was one experience where called the great art robbery, where you were approached by this stereotypical French guy, voiced by me, and my French accent isn't so great. And he asks you, okay, which art masterpiece do you want to steal from a museum? And you choose from three drawings or paintings. And then the next scene is in the middle of the night, both of you break into the museum. He takes off the original painting from the wall, puts a blank painting, and says, okay, there's 1 minute and 1 minute until the cops come. You need to replicate the drawing real quick so no one notices it's gone. And that was really fun. Like, it was so cruel.
There was a twist.
There was
a twist in the story.
Yeah, it was a twist. Everything was crude about it. Like, the painting didn't work so well, but people had so much fun. You know, once you put them in a situation and give them some agency,
yeah,
it was fun. And we put all sorts of, like, hidden interactions where you can, like, paint on the face of your partner during the stressing situation, and he yells at you in his stereotypical French, hey, what are you doing? Come on. And
There's a more basic argument to say about this time of creation.
Okay.
Maybe we can also say it like this. In the ancient time of 2018, VR wasn't exclusively a gaming device.
Right.
Also,
right.
Now it's not exclusively. There's many things you can do with it, but for the general audience, it's a gamer device. Gamers are most likely to put VR headset on and enjoy it and for a long time, like for a few hours. But it wasn't like this so much in 2018. And we didn't know we're making games. We didn't make games. We thought VR is something new, because putting on a VR headset made you, like, people had the idea for the technology. For a long time, there were prototypes, and especially in movies, The Matrix, later Ready Player One, or some forgettable 80s movies about people putting on glasses and getting into a new world. But in those movies, you saw the people putting the glasses, and then you saw them like the movie, and the background changes. It's completely different to be the one who puts it on and feels like you're in a new world. And in film studies, it is very basic concept that the viewer, he has a gaze and there's a window to another world, and this is what cinema is. In VR, it's completely not this. You have presence. And the first thing we did was to figure out, okay, how do you tell a story? How you have character? Because there's no story without characters. Like, there are beautiful gaming experiences of exploration that with sometimes with puzzles, but they will hint characters to make story. You'll find the characters' belongings. But we wanted, because Saf is such a talented animator, we wanted animations and we wanted characters and we wanted drama, but we had no idea how you achieve it. Because the basic VR interactions are not so well designed for drama.
I was just going to say, a lot of the initial positioning of VR really was about action, but only physical action. And there were a lot of games that came out right around that time that focused a ton on the idea of even just the hand buttons, the pressing when the hand controllers came out. All of the focus was on motion and action, and it wasn't about the embodiment or the characters.
Which I think was also, you know, it filled the need of people entering VR for the first time, because you really feel like a toddler, like the magic of picking up something for the first time, throwing something, like it's really an experience of a two-year-old. And it's amazing, and VR does that amazingly. But we were thinking about the next step. How do you tell a deeper story?
And it took us a long while. We had so many wrong ideas.
Yeah, because I think it's interesting to hear, you know, me describing this weird prototype and then Eyal describing the, you know, the philosophy behind it, because the gap was so big between what we were thinking or aspiring, or, you know, the potential that we saw and what we actually made at the time.
It was a difficult time for people to understand that there was so much capacity too, because they were getting inundated with these very basic concepts, right? Like the marketplace itself wasn't reinforcing that there was a lot of momentum in that direction. And so I don't think that people really were imagining the kinds of stories that could be made.
Yeah. And also something else that frustrated us at the time was that there was a lot of energy going into trying to solve storytelling problems, but we thought a lot of the stories, they didn't happen to you, the viewer. Like, it was really common, and still is for some experiences, to put you as a fly on the wall or as the imaginary friend of the hero of the story. And while you can do some really interesting stuff in it, we just found it much more engaging to have you being the person that the story happens to, or rather you being the protagonist.
When you make a really bad prototype, it's really good way to make some base observations. Because if you do a story and the animations are bad and the writing is bad and the sound is bad, but something is working, so you can say, in this story, the different thing was that the player got to advance the plot. And people, and after this, you talk to who played, and we had a variety of players, hardcore gamers, from hardcore gamers to our mother, who always playtest our game. So if our mother gets what's going on, we know, okay, everybody will get it. And for us, we want to make a VR that is very accessible to everyone to enjoy. So this is maybe this is our tip for for anyone trying to make games. Give them to your mother. You will learn a lot. It won't be easy. It won't be easy. She won't understand anything. But if she understands something, everyone will get it.
Yeah, and also I think if something resonates throughout this range, then there's a core there that you can build on.
Yeah, when we were working on Luna, which launched in late 2017, early 2018, right? That was around the time that it came out. For the 3 years that we were working on it, we were just constantly learning new things about what VR enabled, specifically from like even just the camera perspective issues, right? Even just going from, I'm looking down at a little thing that I'm working on, then I'm kind of building something a little bit closer, and now I go into it, you know, just even doing those three perspectives and every level, and like having to design every level from seeing it from space, being in the world, and then being down on the ground in the world and seeing the characters at scale. You know, a lot of the questions I found myself asking were around, what does it mean to have a God's perspective on a thing and then suddenly become small and to be close to it and have it be intimate with you? And if I only tell the story in that moment when you're very tiny, will you somehow access the part of you that is also small? Because the story is about letting go of things that happened in the past, letting go of trauma, you know, moving on from bad memories, or from the analogy in that game is right from the scribble in your belly, the bad thing that you're carrying in your belly, which is how I experience stress. And so I was really asking myself at that time, like, if I bring you closer and closer to the point of the stress or the sickness in that story, which is, you know, taking on things that are not yours, when that piece of moon comes out of the character and goes back up to the sky and they're letting go of that stress, will I also breathe out some of the crap in my belly that I'm carrying around with me? Will some of the stress come out? And I know it sounds so funny, but I really understand what you mean. When you give the headset to someone and they're taken into the world, like we would have little kids reach out and try to touch the turtle, try to hug it, you know, just like on the floor at PAX, you know, where there's like thousands of people walking around, and this, you know, 7-year-old kid is just like, it's so cute. I love turtles, you know? And so I mean, even just talking with you about this, it makes me miss how social that time was, you know, how we could go to places and parties and events and showcases and festivals and experience people experiencing VR for the first time. And that experimental aspect of developing for VR was a huge motivator, I think, for my team. So you were really in the thick of it doing this experimentation. What did you learn?
I think it boils down to for us, and again, it's art, so everybody can take it differently. But after I think it was 30 prototypes, tops, and every prototype was like a different setting, different genre, different interaction. Like we started from scratch and iterated a lot of times. And I think it boiled down to the player being the hero or the viewer being the hero of the story. And because when we did it, like everything just worked better. And we can kind of go into what it means for us. It means that we give the player a specific identity. This is something that you came up with that I think was really effective.
Like in the current game, in the first scene, the player gets to see himself in a mirror, and it's also nice because it's a new experience that only VR enable people. We're on a podcast, so I can't wave my hands around to show people what most users do when they see themselves in the mirror in VR, but it's also the most powerful story tool I've ever used in any story I created, because it make people really know what the character they identify with in the world, and it's a new kind of way to identify or feel identity in a world to really see yourself in a mirror as a private eye, as a robot in the future. This is something that is very important to us. Also, there's a big question about agency and about... here we can't say we learned something that is definitive, because it's something we still think about and still trying to figure out how to, because the story is on rails. We're in the studio, so we can't really make big narrative tree or many choices that leads to many things. We can't make the illusion of it, but people will get us so fast and they'll know it's an illusion that maybe it's not even worth trying. But it is something that people need to feel, that their actions are the thing, is the thing that moving the story forwards, like the okay, so this, and also it's really important to make an emotional arc for the character, that the player is embodying. It's not even playing as, he's playing, if it's done right, after some minutes of gameplay, they'll completely feel like they are this hero in this story. And in our game, it's a detective game. So it's like we're not saying here's the story and here's the puzzle. It's right. You're a detective, you have a puzzle to figure out, you have a case to crack. And then you find things out. Things weren't what you thought they were. Right. Maybe the client, the femme fatale who came to you and you were so suspicious of her, maybe she's in real need. And then players feel things also in a new kind of way, because they feel like it's happening right now to them in this place.
So this idea of engaging with a player, specifically what I'm hearing is it was about embodiment and understanding that the player could experience that embodiment, and then a situational awareness that changes over time that feels personal, right? That you're involved in the experience because you're pushing it forward, and then over time those reveals feel contextual to you in this other body, right? And those two things together create a connection with the character. When you first started testing it and working on it, what didn't work? Like what did you do that inadvertently drove people out of embodiment, for example? What did you find were the biggest, because that's always the, in VR development, that's the thing you got to watch out for, is what are those snags? Because they ruin it, right? So what are some of the snags that you hit, and how did you get rid of them?
I think this is what eventually led us to do a more traditional game, if you will, because we really wanted to do like super experimental stuff where you didn't have like this end goal that is really clear, that you like a challenge that you need to overcome. We wanted everything to be kind of, you know, within its boundaries, be like open. So if you wanna punch a character, then they'll react to it. And I think that didn't work because the first question we got from everyone trying this is, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? And at first, I think it was really annoying to us. Like, what do you mean? What are you supposed to do? Just enjoy the interactive story. But we really, you know, sled gradually toward more, you know, something that is more, something that is, I think, based more on game design principles, if you will.
I think something interesting here. This is the most basic principle for game design and also for narrative. Because how many times you read a screenplay or watch a bad movie and you say, I don't know what their characters are doing. I don't know what they want. I don't know what they're after. And you play a bad game and you're like, okay, what am I supposed to do here? What am I trying to achieve? What are my challenges? I don't know.
Yeah. What's my motivation?
I mean, in VR, you're actually kind of trying to get them to be the actor, right? You're trying to engage them in the role. You're trying to get them to feel like the detective that's going to be betrayed and like has to kind of look, is that a red herring or is it real? You know, is she really trustworthy? Are they going to betray me? You want them to feel those things, which is, you know, when you're in the headset and you're just randomly, you know, knocking things around and in a baby mode, as we also refer to it as that, like baby mode, where people are just hitting everything. You really aren't going to get into the character, right? So like the VR title that we just worked on, and it's like literally just wrapped, the whole first part of it is a long boat ride into a secret place. And you can just baby mode it. You can hit everything.
Oh, cool.
Right away. Because if you don't give them that, they're going to do it the minute they get into your performance. And then they won't be in a role, right? So like, I think it's very interesting because I don't think a lot of people understand just how much you have to do to bring people into that role. And so the what's my motivation becomes, it becomes a critical question. So like, what did you do to get away from people just being in baby mode when they start?
Well, we did the simplest thing. We work with limitations. And from the first moment, from the trailer of the game, from the description, it's a point-and-click adventure game in VR. So we introduced a mechanic. It was one of the mechanics that worked well in one of our prototypes. And we also knew that in a very small team, it is somehow a mechanic you can make a game of, because if you give the players the freedom to act like children and not even, I don't, I'm baby, I, it's maybe a little judgmental, I don't know, but if you give the player the freedom to grab something and throw it, they'll do it. If you don't give it to them, they'll stop trying. So we, in the first scene, we establish, okay, these are the mechanics. You can point at things, your hand, we're using a mechanic, our robot detective can pop his hand out and grab things from afar. And this was our mechanic. This is our, I don't know how to call it. It's not a...
Our shtick.
This is our shtick, exactly. Our extendo arms.
Extendo arms, right.
It's something that people really enjoy, and it's much more easy for us to make. And it's really focused, because then you don't get to do things that will won't feel true to the story. I'm as a gamer, when I play, I always try to see what the boundary is. And if a character is talking to me, I'll try to punch it. Or if it's a shooter, I'll shoot around and they'll keep talking. So we try to work with limitations. And we find that if from the first moment you're very clear about what is the game, what's the limitations, people will go on the ride. They'll get it. They'll say, this is this kind of a game. And other games will give me other things. And it's perfect. And then we can do a little shticks, like Asaf said. We give you a flask to drink of. We'll give you the mirror. We'll give you, we try in every scene to have something that is the magic of VR, something that gives the illusion, the role-playing part. We have this game, but firstly, we lower expectations. Right. This is a point-click game. There are interactables, and people get it. And when the story works, they'll forget the limitations.
Well, and this is one of the things that happens when you work with VR and then you make VR for gamers, is that they have a library of experiences in their head that they can translate into the headset, like a 2D point and click. Whereas when you do a broad audience survey, you get a lot more of the question of what do I do? Because if you take a casual gamer and you put them in most games, people don't have the vernacular of those games, right? And so what was so cool is that you didn't just do what most people do, which is just go back one level to the most recent vernacular, which is shooting. You went way back to, you know, to LucasArts, this feeling, right, of having to figure out what happened and figure out who to trust in a limited set of choices, right? Some of those games are truly clever, you know, because they had to work with limitations. And so when you look at a Myst, you know, or, you know, one of these really early point and clicks, the story really stood out. So you picked the medium that would actually facilitate your goals, and you didn't try to engage in all of the things. Now that you've done one that's somewhat limited, would you consider going to the next level? Like, do you have ideas about that you learned from doing this that you're now like, okay, now I want to try this in full 3D with like physics, like, or are you still like, this is my happy place?
So I think we find some beauty in you know, having a really clean language of the interaction. We think it's really easy to focus the audience on, you know, the lore, the story, the world. And so we do like the type of interaction, but you know, we have some ideas on how to make the experience richer. And so this week I just prototyped an experience where you shoot your extendo arm at some, you know, knob or something, and then rotate it. Like, you have like remote control over your hand, but it's fixed, right? So you point, click, then control your hand a little bit, then click again, then the hand comes back. And so we're still looking at this language of, you know, limiting what you can do within confined space, and, you know, to just convey that it's a puzzle game.
And also, somehow, we don't know how, but the merging we started to do for the VR and point and click, it worked like a charm. Like, it really clicked, and we won't so fast avoid like do something else, because now we made a game that is we can cut it in the editing. I don't want to brag, but I don't want to come across as
no, it's fine. I know what you mean, but it's a good thing to do.
Yeah, but it, okay, let's put it that way. We won't try something else, because we have a lot more to do in this type of interaction. We now know how to make this, and we have so much more narrative to convey and so much more to tell. And if we'll go to something that is more physics-based, we'll lose everything we learned, because maybe...
Yeah. Yeah.
I think going back to the prototypes we did prior to Retropolis,
yeah,
it really made us humble in that sense, because this is the first time we did something so limited, but it allowed us to really expand it into a fully fleshed game, which the most common review for is, it's too short, I want more of it. And so that's a signal for us that
yes,
we need to expand on it.
That is actually one of the most frustrating things about working in VR, is that you do have to take so much time to sort out all of the set design and direction sort of questions and the way that the narrative works. And you have to do it through so much playtesting that to make something, you know, that's longer than even an hour, it takes years and years and years. It's actually, you know, it's not often that I get to talk to VR developers on this show, because there are not that many, you know? So it's yeah, a little
we're,
bit
we're
of a
rare breed.
Yeah, rare breed. It's a little bit of a nerd out moment for me, but like, one of the things that I've thought about
same
a lot
here
with VR is that it's a little bit like sequential art. You know, when you're drawing a comic, you can do things between the panels in the comic book that are really fantastical. It's really amazing how much people will put into the space between two frames of images, right? And how much that edit of just a little blank between the two spaces gives you, it's like almost an infinite amount of space when you think about conceptually how many things you can imply between A and B. Like one of my favorite three panel comics is by Chris Ware, and it's Nancy and Sluggo. I don't know if you know these two characters. It's just a girl and a boy, and they're hanging out, and they're sitting with paper and scissors. And she says, in this middle panel, she says, "Careful with those scissors." And then the last panel is just Sluggo sitting, and the scissors are just in his eyes, and he's holding the paper. There's no blood or anything. It's just that the blades of the scissors are like boom. So it's literally them sitting with scissors, careful with those scissors, and then the accident. And it's just so funny because it's not at all what you would normally see in a Nancy and Sluggo comic. It's usually about two kids doing normal stuff. And the violence of it is intense, but it's not even gory. It's just you remember being told as a child, be careful with those scissors. And then you run the simulation in your head of all the times your mom has said, don't run with scissors, you'll poke your eyes out. And you have this really visceral experience of like being told as a kid, be careful with those scissors. It really gets to that instant thing that we can do in our heads, which is imagine a horrible, horrible process. Yeah. Josh put it up in the chat so that you can see it.
I'm opening it.
It's pretty great.
In another tab. Great. Yeah. What is the name of the, it reminded me of the early Soviet film theorist who talked about editing.
Eisenstein.
Yeah, Eisenstein, also Tartovsky.
Also Kulyashov. Yeah.
Of how, you know, putting one image after another creates new meaning. And in a sense, it feels like these days again in VR, because you don't have a cut in the normal sense. So you need to find, you know, substitutes.
Cut is like a teleport.
Yeah. Exactly. And at the same time, you have all that space, right? Like there's so much extra thing that you can do when you're working through the moments in the experience, and you pull things away from the player, for example, that can be a cut. You know, you can take something out of the scene and or if you put something, like you were saying, one of your shticks, if your shtick is the right kind of shtick, you can get people to access physical memories and like behavior tropes that they've seen over and over again, but they're physically doing it. It's like the doing becomes that little space, you know, it's almost the same kind of access, which is fascinating.
Yeah. And you can play with it a lot. For example, with the extendo arms, there was one time in the game where your hand involuntarily pops out into a cutscene.
Only one time
in the game.
And also we think that in VR, there's a place to really try things. Maybe it's obvious to say, but like the panels of the comics, you can find inspiration in so many art forms. For us, gaming is only one inspiration. I think it's the major inspiration, because in the end, we did made a video game, and it is like 100% video game, and it's
not only a video game, but an adventure game from the early 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah, because people need to know what it is. If you want them to buy it, they need to know, it needs to be that it's like this, I like this, or I don't like this.
Yeah, and it's part of us learning from the prototyping that in the beginning we thought it's VR, we can do anything, let's invent the language. But over time, we understood that we do need the genre, we do need the point of reference, because this allowed us to be much more creative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had the same realization, actually, that the game that we just finished is very much it's not point and click, but it's essentially, it's a physics-based puzzle, but you can move things in three space. But it's a story, fundamentally, about two people. It's just a story. It's a love story, really. And it has its own arc, and you can't change the arc. It's already happened. Exactly the same kind of thing. Because if you don't give people the structure, they get so lost in the options. And I think that that's something that we definitely learned as well.
Is the game out? I'm really curious. No,
not yet. Still getting it to get out. But yeah, we just
sounds super interesting.
The core development, yeah.
Cool.
There's not enough story-based games in VR.
Yeah, that's our feeling as well.
Like we're looking for them.
Why do you think that is? Because I find these issues fascinating. And I mean, you know, at some point we'll have to stop this interview, but I could talk to you for like probably 5 or 6 hours just about like all of the little, you know, the tiny things and the decisions that it's required to do VR development. Why do you think people sort of shy away from the stories? Do you think it's because you have to work so hard to tell a good story or to tell it well in the medium?
So I think for big companies, adapting to a new medium is harder than for indies. But then for indies to actually complete a project is, you know, it's unheard of that, like for us, it's three people. So it's us and Daniel who worked with us, three people who were the only full timers on a 1 hour project. I think it boils down to how do you cheat? How do you find production methods that actually allow you to accomplish something?
Maybe you should reveal our secret.
Yeah.
The secret of Retropolis.
Yeah, it's not one secret, I think. Yeah, it's not one secret, but... No.
The secret is a mindset.
Yeah, it's a mindset, I guess.
Yes.
This is us. We want to make a game. We want
and
to...
we will do whatever it takes.
Yeah, and limitations are opportunities.
That's right.
Like we want, sometimes our cutaways are like a movie screen. Like they're not the immersive experience, it's not the full potential, but it works. And we're so early in VR that using the right limitations, it's innovation.
Yeah,
but you should tell the main shtick.
Yeah, so main shtick again. I think so. Eyal talked about choosing a game mechanic that was cost effective for us, and that's a big part of it, I think. But also on top of that, so basically we were telling about the early prototypes, but then at some point it gradually became more and more close to what we know today as Retropolis, but everything was still in gray boxing, right? And I don't know if on this podcast you need to explain gray boxing, yes or no? No. Everything was boxes with, you know, Google images slapped on them. And even though I did study animation, I was really sucked up in the technical aspect of the project. And, you know, we needed to expand at that point. And Daniel, who is a really good friend of mine from animation school, and then we worked together after it, he just quit his job as well. And I approached him and asked about, hey, could you give a hand in some concept art? So we did, and he started doing some sketches.
That was the beginning of the end for Daniel.
Exactly.
Our first idea, I don't know if we told it to Daniel so bluntly, but we wanted some concept art splashed on Unity cubes.
Cubes, yeah.
It was just because we didn't think it through at the time. We didn't really know how we were going to finish the game. But we think, okay, if we'll put some original concept art on a cube, then maybe we can get something going, you know, take the project one step further. And that was an idea we had. And also we wanted to kind of explore it visually more while we're still developing the mechanics and the story and the world. But we still had no idea how we're going to do, you know, a whole 3D realization of our, you know, idea, because usually you need a really big budget for modeling, animation, texturing, lighting, rigging, you know, the drill. And at the time I was following, the Quill animation community.
Yeah,
if you heard of it.
We do prototypes in Quill all the time.
Yeah, amazing tool. And we just thought it would be, you know, an interesting thing to try at least. Like maybe it'll help us, you know, find a breakthrough in how we're going to make the assets. And so that was also something that brought Daniel closer to the project, because we game jammed with him. It was the first time he used Quill, but he's an amazing artist. He draws beautifully. He has an amazing... perception of 3D and animation in space and timing, etc. And it just clicked, like the way Eyal and I clicked, working together on creative ideas. It just felt like an expansion of that. And it, you know, just allowed us to really rapidly you know, start switching these back boxes with fleshed out, beautiful environments that Daniel drew and animated.
It's amazing how much you get from the visuals, right? I mean, it's amazing how quickly when you put yourself in a space, even if it's just a few lines with Quill, how much you get from it. You know, the minimalism that you're talking about that you've embraced, I think it's actually the secret. It is the secret to most things in VR. You do a lot more with a lot less when the person is experiencing it from inside the headset. And right. I think a lot of the opportunity to create synesthetic experiences and to kind of push the boundary of what it feels like to be embodied in that space is what we've been most interested at Phenomena. But I actually think that the other really, really juicy place to be is where you are. Like, I actually think there's really important work to be done both at the end of the, like, how do you get the story to feel personal? And also, how do you get the world to feel like you're impacting it? Like, I think they're actually very difficult problems. And like, the community has kind of been in the very middle of like, well, we don't have to do too much drama or really worry about the physics if you just have this one activity, you know, whether it's like throwing stuff or moving your physical body very quickly or like shooting. That's really dead in the middle of like not having to embrace either problem. And I think if you try to embrace both, then you would just go crazy because you would be working on too many things at once. It would be too hard. And
yeah,
so
certainly, you know, as a small team, right?
Yeah. The design, the open-endedness of the design would be too hard. So I think it's really fascinating. And like, if you look at the titles that are available now in, let's call this the narrative end of the spectrum, you know, and games that are really trying to push story forward. Was there anything that really inspired you that was in VR, or did all the inspirations come from the sort of noir slash detective novel tropes, which were so popular in the point and click genre?
I think it's also an opportunity to talk about some noir inspirations that came outside of gaming, right?
Yeah, that's great.
AL did a bunch of reading before writing this the screenwriter Philip K. Dick or no Raymond Chandler
also yeah. Philip K. Dick yeah. do yeah. Android's Dream of Electric Sheep but also it's the first time I read Raymond Chandler, which we all saw the movies and we all know the stories and the private detective, but once you read it, it's so good. It's so fresh. And I thought like, it's going to be cynical and funny. But the funny part came later in the movies. It is witty, but it's so sad. And it was a poet. He was a poet before he wrote the B novels. Pulp Fiction, crime, but you can read. This is something a poet wrote. And I really tried to think about it, that noir doesn't have to be about being funny all the time or being so mysterious. It's about the mood. And sometimes you need to be funny, and sometimes you need to get the mood right. And I think that in this place, a virtual reality is by Tender Claws was a great inspiration. I think it's a great game. It came out pretty early the time we did the prototypes. And yeah,
Before we even imagined Retropolis.
Yeah. And I think they did some really interesting stuff. With also, they didn't had exactly point and click, but they played around with it, and you had some kind of whip to catch things from afar, and as you did it, they had characters like, I think it was an artichoke in one part, but it talked, and in virtual reality it just worked. Like, if an artichoke is talking, you listen.
I particularly remember talking to a butter toast.
Yeah, there's a butter toast.
That was a great part.
And it's so funny. And then it's get really mysterious with layers of reality. Our game is starting with a VR headset coming to the user. When after he says, after he clicks new game part one, there's a retro-futuristic VR headset that comes to him. And I think it's kind of inspiration from them.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, their team is fantastic, Tenderclaws, and we are friends. We talk as VR developers do. And I know they'll be really thrilled to get the shout out because they worked very hard on all their products. They work very hard on trying to figure out how to bring the stage and the beauty of really good set direction and set design as well as narrative design into the space. And
it totally shows. Can tell a lot of love went into this project.
Well, and this is one of the other things, right? Like the hardest stuff to do in VR is not visible because it's not really in the title. It's what you don't put in. It's all the visual whiz bangs and all the like literally Lawnmower Man stuff that you don't put in is actually the restraint and the editing is actually a huge part of it, right?
In all art, when people experience art, they don't want to know how hard it was to make it. It needs to feel flawless. You should tell people, I had an inspiration one night, I sat down and I just wrote it. It came out like this. This is how they'll enjoy it. Yeah. If you'll tell them, I had so many iterations, I had so many mistakes. In the middle, we had to take a character, change it, write everything, record the actor again because it didn't work. They don't want to experience it. They don't want it. You need to say, oh, it was so flawless.
It's part of show business, I guess.
It's part of show business.
We're learning this now as we just released our first game out that, you know, the difference between how things are perceived and how it actually felt to make it.
This is something that's really interesting in VR because we somehow, in Hebrew, we can say someone is dancing on both weddings. Maybe it's eating the cake and have it too.
Yeah, or holding the, yeah.
So doing is sometimes for this podcast, we're a gaming company that makes VR. But we also went to Cannes Film Festival. And there, we're Safi is the producer, and I'm the director. And
you need to have credentials that match the film industry as they know it.
Yeah, and our game is exactly in the middle. You can go to a film lover and say, oh, it's like The Big Sleep or Casablanca, and they'll be thrilled. And you can go to someone who's game festival, and you say, oh, it's like LucasArts. You need to know what to tell them so they want to play it. And I think that's what interesting, the people from the movie business, they try the game and they say, wow, it's so interesting. I do things. I'm like the character. It's active. It's not passive. And you give it to gamers and they say, oh, the story is interesting. The aesthetics, the cinematics.
Yeah.
So we really believe in VR, you have to do something in the middle. Yeah. We want to do it.
It's really a place where the traditional boundaries between what gaming is and what cinema is kind of dissolve into, I guess, something new that is evolving before our eyes.
Yeah, actually, I sit on the Game Developers Conference board for VR AR Summit. And we used to have a separation between the entertainment summit and the game summit. And we're not doing that anymore because everything is blending together, you know, like the concept of entertainment in VR and the concept of game in VR
the separation.
It's amazing. Even the, what's the name of the game you just, Pistol Whip. It's such a classic shooter, but their new campaign is much more rich on the story end of it. That it's amazing. Like it's, or you know, not to mention Half-Life Alyx, which is, you know,
the best VR game and makes all of us only like amateurs.
It just like happened to be the like most technically advanced game of its kind ever made.
With an amazing story.
Yeah, but it's technically advanced, but it also is really, you know, it's really smart on the creative side as well, like the storytelling aspect.
I think there is something very interesting to say here, because we used voiceover when we started to do it, and it was a question. But we did a genre. You play a detective, and people, like, they know if it's a detective film, there will be a voiceover. And it's working with a point and click. You try to click in something, and it says, it lock. I need a key. It's the simplest thing. But we thought maybe people
don't
want.
Maybe we're making a mistake here. Maybe it's wrong. Maybe we're not against it.
Then Half-Life Alyx came, and they had voiceover. You play as Alyx. You play as the story as the hero. Yeah. And we said, oh my God, we're on something that they're doing.
We're onto something because, you know,
but
what
I just want to say, Half-Life is known for a silent protagonist. They're known for it. And it's very interesting that in VR, they use the voiceover. And for us, it was like an exciting moment just to know that in Half-Life, they're using something that we're already prototyping with.
Yeah,
a story.
We played it during the lockdowns, but we called each other, hey, they're using voiceover. Great. Okay, we're keeping the voiceover in.
There's a huge spectrum of things that can be done inside of the narrative space. And what I'm hearing you say is that the work that you've got to do is the same work that you always have to do, which is editing. But I also kind of want to point this out. A lot of us in games for a long time, we didn't edit. Like a lot of our stories are just reams and reams and reams and reams of text and characters that talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. And they say things that are like, wow, nice red sweater, which you don't have to say. If the character has a red sweater on, you just say, nice sweater, cool outfit. You know, but we were not really, we didn't come from a narrative background, right? We came from a toy and hobbyist background as an industry. And so I think it's really exciting to kind of the two of you to be working kind of in like game and narrative. Do your roles split that way? Like, do you think of yourselves as like a game designer and a screenwriter? Or do you think of yourselves as like two people that like games and film and you're working together, like just brothers? Like, what? How does it work between the two?
That's interesting.
Well, if you want to make a game, there's supposed to be roles.
Yeah.
Like when we talk about games or movies, we don't have hats and you're the gaming guy and I'm the film guy.
Yeah.
But when you do a game, there's supposed to be work done and there's supposed to be someone who's doing it. The game design, we don't have a game designer.
Yeah, I think the game design kind of was a split between us three eventually after Daniel came in, because he also brought a lot of game design ideas. And so that was kind of a brain trust of like how to design the game and then the particular levels. But other than the game design, everything was really, you know, solid, as Eyal was the screenwriter director, Daniel was the art director, and I was, let's say, the producer, programmer.
Yeah, you're the programmer. You're making it happen. I think that this the reason I asked this question about design is that my experience in VR, working with several different teams on several, actually AR as well, and even mobile AR, is that because the problem solving environment is so rich, and there's so many things that you have to work together on, that there's no way to have a designer. There's no way to have an idea person on a VR title.
That's right.
Like, you just can't. Like, you can't be the person that says, and then X will happen. You need to be in it. And even when you're building it, sometimes as a programmer, you'll have an intuition about what's going on because you put something in the headset and then you get in there and it's like, you just feel like I just finished doing some tuning on a system. And the way it felt when we first designed it on paper seemed cool. Like, I liked the idea of it. And then when we put it in the headset, it was so confusing. And like, we're squarely at the other end of the spectrum where our narrative treatment is really light and we're really focusing on the on the controls and on the physical embodiment and how it affects your ability to tell a narrative to someone. and how much physical movement impacts your ability to feel a specific emotion. And like the confusing part of the design took a year to cut away, you know? And it was a totally collaborative process with everyone on the team. I can't think of a single person, the sound designer, all of the artists, the animator, you know, the programmers, the art director, like everyone had, the producer, everybody had thoughts all the time about what was and wasn't working. I think it's actually really helpful to have a tiny team because your communication flow is going to be really strong.
Yeah, right? Everybody has a voice, and that's really important to us. And we also want to give the project an opportunity to tell us what it needs to change. So as you said, you try something and it doesn't work out, you need to adapt. But that doesn't mean that you don't need to have like some sort of creative direction in terms of, so
you
when
you gotta know where you're headed.
Yeah, Eyal kind of came up with the, you know, the genre and the goal and the feeling we were aiming at. But then on top of that, we had iterations and we had meetings and we had like everyone, you know, give their best ideas. And that was what I think, you know, made the project better eventually.
How long did it take? How long did it take you guys to get it from start to finish?
So we started pre-production on, you know, a detective point-and-click game on October 2019.
Yeah. But it was pre-production. This is the time we did Unity gray box with boxes instead of art.
Yeah. It was really early.
And the production phase,
let's think,
a year and a half ago.
Yeah,
maybe.
Okay, so yeah, and so that's about, yeah. I think that's standard for an innovation in VR, about 3 years, where you do a lot of thinking up to the point that you really understand what you want to build.
You accumulate enough know-how to kind of make something real in the world.
Yeah, I think especially if you can, you almost have to keep things minimal because the budgets are so small. You know, if like you're doing something for an actual budget, they're tiny and the labor is high. So you have to keep it minimal. And I think about a year and a half is a reasonable amount of time to sort of, okay, now we're really gonna go for it, you know? What do you like most about the experience now that it's finished and like you're reading your reviews? What do you like the most? I mean, like, what do you think you did the best? I'm going to ask you to brag about yourselves.
Okay.
It's hard.
So personally, as the developer, I liked that all the reviews talked about lore and music and visuals and not about there weren't any bugs.
Yeah.
Or there weren't a lot of bugs, you know,
because someone
did refer to that recently, but most people, you know, it was just transparent to them.
He referred to the, he's not used for VR game releasing without bugs.
Yeah.
This was the review.
Someone told us that on Steam and that was really heartwarming. But, you know, the fact that this was an exception was really great for me because like, okay, I know that on this front, at least we did a really good job. That people just referred to, you know, the story that we told. And I think it also shows that our game design decisions were smart, as in we were really afraid of, you know, the voiceover being a problem and not being able to, you know, throw stuff and, you know, physically based puzzles would be something that people miss, and it's not something that shows up in the comments so much.
So you're standing out on your own terms, which is really, it's always lovely to get those reviews where people are like, this changed my idea about what storytelling could be, or oh, I really enjoyed the story, or oh my gosh, it's a great story.
Exactly. Like, people were just like, okay, you know, immersed in a new world, and for me that's you know, more than I could ask for.
That's
and
great.
Honestly, reading the reviews is hard. Even if the reviews are good. it's... Well,
tell us.
Fortunately, our reviews were good. We had good reviews. The main thing people had to say, both big reviewers, reviewers on Steam, it needs to be longer. People want more. Which is the best thing you can hope for as a developer. It means you're onto something that people want it. But honestly, getting something that is honest and you try to say something that is meaningful and now it's out there, it's some sometimes you can feel exposed or like everybody's seeing your like the creation, the process of creation we did was very intimate. We're working underground. We're literally an underground VR dev group. We weren't seeing much light. We saw people only on the playtests, maybe on the Zoom. We worked through lockdown. And now getting out what we did, it's like putting out something that is very intimate and close to you. And I think something that is really hard and why people are afraid of making narrative games is that you try to say something, and it's very scary to say something that is honest and try to say something that has meaning. What if people see another meaning in it? What if they don't like it? What if they don't like the part that is the line you say, oh, this is my line, this is me, this is my wit. Yeah. And that the line they say, yeah, I didn't like this line. If you do something that is not narrative, you can always say, I'll fix it in the update. Yeah. I'll do something in the update. This is the genre. But in narrative, people play it one time.
Yeah.
If they really liked it, in 1 year, they'll play it again. But if the narrative is interesting, they'll do it. If not, they won't do it. And it's something that is very scary. But what I like about the game that it means something. Basically, doing the retrofuturism in something that is out there. Because VR is so retrofuturistic.
Yeah.
Like, I think half of the experiences are 80s themed because large segment of the market grew up in the 80s or right after the 80s, and they miss it so much, and we wanted to go to the 50s to make it even more bluntly, so even people didn't play the game, they notice there's something weird here. Is it futuristic VR going to the metaverse, or this is going back?
Yeah.
And only having this question is meaningful. You wanted to say something.
Yeah. So I think you said that you're afraid that people won't like the game, but then you're saying also that reading good reviews is hard. And I think what you're saying here is, or at least that's how I feel, that sometimes it's hard that people don't like the game the way you think they would.
They should, yeah.
Yeah.
When you're doing something so personal, but that's the reality of it. And of course, we're so honored and basically surprised. Like, going to Cannes Film Festival was way beyond anything we expected that would happen with this project when we started with it. And the reception after coming out with the game was just overwhelming.
This is a good place to be.
Yeah, getting a bunch of good streamers. And I mean, we don't have any budget to pay streamers. It means only that they found the game interesting. And our game is very far from the favorite game for streamers, because there's a voiceover.
Yeah.
And the character in the game is saying everything, and the streamers love to say their own thing.
Yes.
But we saw they do it good.
Yeah, I really enjoyed watching Let's Play of the game, honestly. And that's something that was really surprising for me.
That's great. It's really great. I mean, I think that when you think about the future and where VR is going, do you feel like you'll stay in the medium? Like, this is going to be your thing for a while?
Oh, definitely.
That's great.
We don't want to be anywhere else.
I really, really appreciate the two of you taking time to talk with me today. I know the audience is going to get such a kick out of hearing about your sort of influences and the things that you are trying to do, what your shtick is, and what the secret really is behind the secret of Ergopolis. So I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much, Robin. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
So much fun.
Yeah,
really. We try to talk about these things with anybody, but usually they don't listen. They want to play the game, but they won't listen to us to do it about how we got there.
No, this is what the podcast exists for, is to give people a chance to sort of have a platform to talk about all the hard stuff and celebrate it, because being a game developer is hard, being a game maker is hard, but it is so rewarding. And it's great to just know that there are people like you working in the space trying to make new things and like solve these hard problems like one moment at a time, you know? So here's to the next iteration, you know, hopefully it's 4 hours longer.
Cheers to that.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.
The Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences is excited to share that the 2022 DICE Summit and DICE Awards will be returning in person to the gorgeous Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino and Delano Hotel in Las Vegas on February 22nd to 24th, 2022. We'll be celebrating the 25th anniversary of the DICE Awards and bringing together industry leaders to share their ideas about the many facets of the interactive entertainment industry. Stay tuned to www.interactive.org and our Twitter, @official_AIAS, for more details coming soon, including special anniversary rates. We can't wait to see you again.